So I wanted to start today's talk about the system behind gender and sexual oppression with two recent events. The first event is the appalling abortion ban that has just been enacted in Texas on the 1st of this month. The Texas Heartbeat Bill, as it's called, is one of the most restrictive abortion acts in the United States and essentially bans the procedure, making it illegal once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. This is a stage in pregnancy that can happen before a person even knows they're pregnant. It's one of the most regressive attacks actually that's happened in the United States for some time. And it's also what set up what has been called a state-led bounty hunt on anyone that facilitates a woman's access to abortion. It allows anyone in or outside the state of Texas to sue those who are seen to be aiding or abetting the procedure. And this is an incredibly widespread, sweeping breadth of potential targets. Doctors, abortion providers, women's health clinics, partners, and even Uber drivers who might transport patients can be prosecuted by anti-abortion activists for up to $10,000 in the court of law. And the second event that I want to draw attention to is something that's also happened quite recently, and it's across the border to Texas in Mexico, where things are moving in a pretty different direction. The Mexico Supreme Court has just historically ruled to decriminalize abortion, which comes off the back of years of struggle for women's reproductive rights by what's known as the Green Wave, called as such for what's pictured here, which is the iconic green bandanas worn by activists across the region. And whilst there's still wins to be had in Mexico around abortion, the ruling doesn't immediately legalize the procedure, it sets a precedent for those facing prosecution in a country where up to 1 million illicit, that's like backyard, unsafe, illegal abortions occur annually. And after the legislation that legalized abortion in Argentina last year, it's an emboldening step forward, I think, for the Latin American movement for reproductive rights. And comparing these two events, I think two things are clear. One is that we live in a system bent on gender and sexual oppression. But like all forms of oppression, it's also a system that has been met with resistance and at times immense struggle. So today, I want to put forward the Marxist case for what this system is all about. What does gender and sexual oppression look like? What structures is it built into? And where did it come from? And importantly, I think most importantly, how can we build the strength of our side to win a world free of it forever? Beyond Texas, it doesn't take much to uncover the manifestations of gender and sexual oppression today. I'm sure everyone here has plenty of examples that pop into their heads when they hear the words sexism, homophobia, misogyny. And to begin at perhaps the most blatantly vile end of the spectrum, we can look at the sexist and reactionary far right that thrives across the world. This slide is devoted to trad wives, so I'll go a little more into those in a second. The far right loves to espouse traditional family values, and it spreads sexist and homophobic attacks everywhere it goes. To them, the ultimate goal is to have women's social positions relegated back into the submissive devotion of the family and husband. They've even developed this name for it, trad wives. The anti-feminist woman who rejects modern notions of autonomy and equality. Instead, the role of women is to understand that giving up modern working ambitions and embracing domesticity is the best thing you can do. Women who don't appreciate this notion, women who want to fight for their rights and autonomy, are hounded and abused by the far right and are often subjects of gross violence by incel fascists. And I know trad wife, which is the combination of the words traditional wife into a hashtag, sounds like a satirical gag, but unfortunately it's not. It's actually really popular amongst the far right. And trad wives are just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the right's reactionary obsession with maintaining strict gender and sexual identities. Homophobia and transphobia are the natural partners of their misogyny. In Poland this year, where trad wives are very popular amongst the far right, the ultra-nationalist Law and Justice Party rules, and alongside them, one of Europe's biggest far right thrives. The image here is of the still current president of the Law and Justice Party speaking at the 100th anniversary of independence in Poland to a rally of over 200,000 nationalists who marched in a demonstration organized by the far right explicitly. The party has happily used their time and power in Poland to wind back women's hard-fought for rights in a country which, off the back of workers' struggle, actually once had free and on-demand abortion. Like Texas this year, at the start of this year, Poland also created an essential abortion ban, which was met with some of the biggest protests in the country for decades. Alongside their attacks on women, the far right also targets the gay community. Nearly 100 towns have established LGBTI-free zones, vitriolic areas against LGBTI ideology, which technically have no enforceable power, but are important symbolic and cultural markers made by the far right to impose fear and violence into the oppressed. And I've added a little map of the zones as they stood last year here. But it's not just these kind of far right figures. Actually, here in Australia, there's similar campaigns against LGBTI ideology. And I couldn't help but include a little slide about Scott Morrison. Our own Prime Minister, pictured here, you know, a family man who's always taking his family on holidays to Hawaii despite national crises like the bushfire, and is always asking his wife Jenny to help clarify him things, clarify things for him, like his, you know, whether he should have human empathy. He's campaigned for several years to introduce an insidious religious discrimination bill. And let's move on to maybe a nicer slide of some of the staunch comrades fighting against this guy. So the many iterations of these religious discrimination bills have been outright attacks on marriage equality and its victory in 2017, and are about an attempt of winding back hard-won gains. It assigns the same virtues as the far-right's trad wife to the holy gender binary. The bill includes an attempted amendment of the Marriage Act, which states that, and I quote, "A man and a woman united in marriage with their children is the fundamental building block of human society, modelling for children the gender difference and complementary nature of the man and the woman." And Scott Morrison isn't alone in espousing these conservative and bizarre ideals. Currently, One Nation Senator Mark Latham, who's pictured here with far-right scumbag Milo Yiannopoulos, heads a transphobic campaign to introduce a similar parental rights bill in New South Wales that would prohibit schools, teachers and training courses from teaching gender fluidity. This scary notion, of gender fluidity is defined by Latham's bill as a belief there is a difference between the biological sex and human gender, and that human gender is socially constructed, which sounds pretty good to me and probably to everyone here and to the hundreds of people that have protested the bill in New South Wales. But to Latham and the various members of the Liberal and Labor Party who support his bill, this is simply the undoing of the building blocks of civilization. And it's not really that surprising that you can reach into our political system and pull out these homophobic and sexist creeps. Another marker of the state of sexism and misogyny today is what happened only a few months ago when the bottomless pit of sexism and misogyny in the Australian Parliament was revealed. The report by Brittany Higgins of her assault inside Parliament House by a fellow Liberal staffer that was covered up and silenced by politicians like her boss and Liberal frontbencher Linda Reynolds set off a wave of stories of abuse, bullying and sexism at the hands of the most powerful people in Australia. One of the most high profile of these cases was, of course, the revelations surrounding Attorney General Christian Porter and the rape of the woman that he knew in high school when she was 16, a woman who has since committed suicide. And like, there's no words to describe like the just rotten, disgusting nature of this man, and despite, you know, his crocodile tears when he was pulled and hauled into the media to acknowledge his crime, Porter's behaviour has never changed. As I pictured before, actually, he was standing next to Scott Morrison as a key proponent of the religious discrimination bills. His openly chauvinistic and sexist behaviour is well documented. In 2020, a whole Four Corners report was devoted to him and the current education minister, Alan Tudge. Because like many in the ruling class, he is deeply confident in his right to treat women as objects, so much so that he's even recently taken out a defamation lawsuit against the ABC's reporting of his historic sexual assault. So these are just some of the enemies, I suppose, the far right, the politicians that populate the halls of Australian Parliament that exist in the struggle for sexual and gender liberation. And I put alongside each picture of them some of the thorns in their side, activists who, like us here today, want to fight to see these things dismantled forever. But clearly, women's and LGBT oppression is embedded more deeply into our system than just these kind of very explicit, outright representations. as soon as we're born, we're allocated into one of two deeply constructed gender binaries, girl or boy, and we're taught how to fulfill these social identities. One of the most important and immediate places of this socialization is in the family. And this remains today, even though there's certainly an idea that, you know, most people feel that they've overcome such rigid definitions. In 2014, a study showed that despite a growth in egalitarian attitudes towards gender, parents are still more likely to provide, you know, toy vehicles, action figures, sports equipment to their sons and give dolls, kitchen sets and dress-up toys to their daughters. And despite attitudes changing, toys are actually more gendered than ever before. Almost every inch of advertising and packaging for things for young children is created to imply that whatever your child is playing with, whatever they're eating, whatever they're watching on television is meant to either be for a strong little boy or a pretty little girl. And it's not just toys. Even the most minute interactions that adults have with young children unconsciously are shown to reinforce gender norms. Studies have found that when adults smile at children, they're more likely to subconsciously smile when they're behaving in typically gendered ways. So encouraging boys when they play and encouraging girls when they're behaving quietly or keeping to themselves. Parents are even more likely to unconsciously believe that their daughter has a greater risk of injury just during their daily activity because of the implicit sense that her gender is more fragile. And this all takes place while infants are trying to grapple with the world around them and develop understandings of social categories to fit things into. And once children enter the education system, where they're forced into, you know, skirts or pants and met with daily affirmations of good morning, boys and girls, this binary dynamic only intensifies. Young girls are taught from this age what is appropriate for them to be interested in and what's not, what they will be good at and what they won't be. Classes are gendered, toilets, hobbies, and everything in between. And this doesn't just stop when you're in the classroom. I think this statistic about maths that I delved into a rabbit hole of is really indicative of how those gendered socializations of what you're meant to be good at and what you're not stay with you for the rest of your life. And then after we go to school, we go into the home where our own mothers and fathers in turn teach us what each gender's social place and responsibility are. And despite the fact that actually today most people don't even live in the stereotypical heterosexual families of a married man and woman, and mother or father, the idealized images of what these mothers and fathers are provide a relentless sociological function. So the socialization of women to be quiet, underconfident, and to see their skills as nurturing, maternal, begins in the experiences we have during these early years and the structures that we're put into. And it's not hard to see how trans and gay existence is at odds with this socialization. As Marxist Sherry Wolfe writes, after all, if a woman can look and act like men and men can look and act like women, and if men and women can have same-sex relationships, embody attributes conventionally attributed exclusively to men or women and the other gender and familial norms are thrown into question. A socialization campaign to reject these ideas is impressed upon us from just as early on as a result. And then on top of all of this implicit socialization, you have multi-billion dollar industries of sex, beauty, and the media demanding women endlessly contort themselves into commodified images of beauty and sexual availability. So when you step back from all of that, the amount of effort it goes into teaching us how to be men and how to be women demonstrates pretty clearly that there's not really a single natural thing about it. All of this socialization has a purpose. It has a purpose in providing capitalism with the most desirable functioning of society for its needs. So capitalism is a system of class division, where a small minority, a profit-driven minority, rule over the majority. The working class, which makes up most of the population, are forced to work in order to survive and in turn produce insane wealth for the capitalists who own the means through which we produce anything. And whilst it's our collective labour that allows society to function, we have no control over what we create or what we do. This is a system which is highly illogical, has been shown, again, to be crisis-ridden and deeply anti-human. In order for a system like this to survive, it necessitates divisive and oppressive ideas to be driven down into the working class, to obscure the realities of class domination. Gender and sexual oppression are fundamental parts of this. Far from being the product of bad ideas that exist in our heads or biology, it's a material phenomenon that's structurally embedded into capitalism for its gain. Often the backwards and conservative ideas like gender roles and homophobia are just seen as products of human nature. But in reality, oppression and division are dissipated from the top down through endless ideological, political, and economic structures, some of which I've gone through talking about the socialization of young children. The working class is pitted against each other daily, often through a myriad of artificial divisions and oppression to drive against this collective power that's actually capable of breaking the capitalist control. So all of the ideology around human nature, womanhood, sexuality are symptoms of structural realities, not separate from them. And there are two key structures that underpin women's oppression and consequently sexual oppression as well. The first is the economic exploitation that women face in the workforce. So women make up a significant amount of the global workforce, over 50% in a lot of statistics. And their labour makes up an important form of exploitation for the bosses, but it's riven with inequality. To start, I thought we could look at the gender wage gap. In Australia, it currently hovers just below or just above 15%. And concretely, this gender wage gap means that women working full-time earn on average $260 to $320 less than their male counterparts every week. In a year, that amounts to about $25,000 less in annual pay. In the part-time industry, it's an even bigger gap of $486 less per week. And the reason the gap gets so much bigger is because women actually make up 75% of part-time employees in Australia and only make up 38% of full-timers. There's a myriad of things that deepen this inequality, like the unionisation levels of these industries, as well as women who experience multiple forms of oppression, such as Aboriginal, migrant, lesbian, transgender, and disabled women who face compounded discrimination in relation to employment. This disparity in wages is highly profitable and is a central way that bosses increase the value that they can extract from their workforce. Feminized industries are another structural example of increasing this value of exploitation. These are areas of the workforce that over time have come to be predominantly staffed by women and as a result are chronically underfunded and underpaid. Early childhood education, community services and health workers are all examples of feminized workforces. A 50-year study actually between 1950 and 2000 in Australia showed that when women enter an occupation in high numbers, it undergoes systematic devaluation. And that's to say when women enter an occupation, the pay decreases for all workers and the occupation experiences a regression in its perceived importance. The myth that the work that women do is easier or of less value is facilitated by the gendered assumptions that we're taught from birth about womanhood that I discussed earlier. And often feminized industries are dominated by the idea that women are fulfilling instinctive maternal urges within them and they don't need pay. But as the nurses in 1986 said, dedication doesn't pay the rent. And as has been shown in spades by the pandemic, there's nothing innately easy or unimportant or anything like that about any of this work or work that women do. It's critical and that they make up skill sections of the workforce. I think one of the other myths that come out of feminized industries, when you see like the slides show here, how starkly they could be gender divided and the pay gap is that it's the men in the working class that take home the difference in pay. But an equal pay case brought forward by the Australian Services Union in 2011 found that the remaining 14% of men who are in the feminised social and community services industries actually share the same impact of lower pay rates as their female co-workers. It's the same for nurses and it's the same for early childhood workers. Study after study of gendered wages shows that the millions of dollars that go unpaid to women don't translate actually into the wages of men increasing. Instead, the gap puts a downward pressure on the overall wages of the entire working class. It's actually a wedge, a conscious wedge that employers use to drive down all wages they have to pay. It creates divisive competition between male and female workers, and it uses the lower pay rate to undercut higher wages. So despite the appearance that men benefit from the pay gap, the reality is the complete opposite. Actually, It's in the self-interest of male workers to oppose it. The economic disparity that women face at work reinforces a whole swathe of other social and economic oppressions. Currently, the fastest growing layer of people in Australia facing homelessness and poverty is women in their 50s, 60s and 70s. Women make up the majority of public housing tenants in Australia, as well as welfare recipients. It's difficult for women to escape domestic abuse situations, for example, because of the economic insecurity they experience at work and the total lack of community services they have. A second key institution to the gender and sexual oppression that exists in our system is one that's not usually thought as an institution. It's the family. So beyond the socialization role that I talked about earlier, the family is actually an integral economic institution for capitalism. It's responsible for maintaining the ongoing reproduction of the working class. A ready supply of exploitable labor power at the lowest possible cost is one of the most important considerations for our ruling class. It's how their profit and society is produced and runs. And the family represents, actually, as an institution, the privatization of this extraordinary amount of socially necessary labor that goes into making this possible. So initially, during the emergence of industrial capitalism, the project of the ruling class in reproducing the working class looked a little bit different to today. And I've pictured that here with the union workhouse. The conditions of 19th century Britain were brutal during the emergence of capitalism, to say the least. Men and women of all ages were sent to work in industry for 12, 13-hour shifts, only to sleep and return the next day. Maiming, impoverishment, death, disease were par for the course for the early industrial working class. And to accommodate this new form of production, the pre-existing feudal family that lived off the land had to be split up so they could be forced into industry to sell their labour. Workhouses were established that divided poor married men and women and even children by gender so they could be housed while moving to the cities for work. And you can see that gender division in the little picture here. These workhouses were notorious for their horrid conditions. If workers were lucky to be able to avoid them, the threat of living in one was used to keep them from abandoning paid work to return to the feudal countryside. Marx and Engels actually believed that this ruthless ripping apart of social relations would see the end of the family for good and the end of the women's role in the domestic sphere so she could be fully exploited day in, day out in the workforce. However, this did not come to fruition. And the family, which is pictured here, the nuclear 1950s family, actually came into being. So with both men, this is because with both men and women working for days on end, infants were not left, were not really cared for because their mothers were at work, their parents were at work. So instead they were often left to be looked after in these workhouses or by other children that were still too young to be put to work in the factory. Infant death from disease and malnutrition and child death of labour, of children that were forced to work, became wide sweeping. It was not uncommon that infants who were restless because of poor conditions would be given opium to sedate them in early Victorian England. And overdose also became a regular cause of death. So the reproduction of the working class in these new productive relations was jeopardised. Combined with workers' resistance to the workhouses, which, you know, divided them up on the most kind of ridiculous of levels and their horrific conditions in the workforce, early capitalism's attempt at constructing a new form of reproduction based on sending every man, woman to work and child to work was forced to change. So in answer to assure the need in answer to reassure the reproduction of the working class, aka that all these new workers didn't just die, as well as to deal with the rebellion of the working class, notions of childhood and traditional spheres of gender were reconcretized by ideological and legislative campaigns. Children, and then later on women, had impositions placed on the amount of time they could work in a day. These restrictions helped usher women back into domesticity, and a family structure emerged based on their oppression as the carers of children. Importantly, these families, both working women and men were tied to the home. Women were tied in to raise the next generation of workers, and men were tied in because these families required their income in order to survive, so the state didn't have to pay for raising the next generation of workers. But women were not removed entirely from the workforce. Ever since their entry, women have remained to be an integral part of production and exploitation. So instead of separate spheres emerging, built into the family under capitalism is the dual oppression of women. Despite needing to assert the importance of women in the home for social reproduction, capitalism still wants to exploit them for their labor in the workforce. Today, whilst men and women spend similar time in wage labor, 90% of parental leave is still taken by women, and they spend twice as much time doing domestic unpaid work. If the domestic work done in the home was done by state-run industries, it would cost the state an estimated $650 billion annually in Australia alone in order to raise the next generation of workers. This unequal dynamic is an inescapable reality of capitalism. And it's an inescapable reality of working class heterosexual families. It's intensified even in same-sex and single-parent households. When a working family has children, it's highly unlikely that they'll be able to afford the exorbitant costs of childcare to both continue working. Instead, a parent will stay home to look after the child. As evidenced by the statistic of 97% of parental leave being taken by women, overwhelmingly, the woman ends up being the person that stays home to look after the children. And while in some cases this division of labour is informed by ideology about women's role in the home, it's increasingly the result of necessary economic calculations. Because if you think about it, if you're working class, it just makes economic sense that the most important wage to keep is the higher one if it's your household's only income. So it's not simply by individual choice that these gender roles in the family persist. Even the most anti-sexist and progressive couples can't escape the reality that women earn less than their male partners, and women earn less overall. A decision that keeps women in the home, which is made up by bosses, not husbands. And this decision made as a result, you know, made in the family as a result of women's exploitation, reinforces the dynamic of women being forced into less stable, part-time, casualized industries. Even if they have no intention of doing so, employers routinely will just assume that women are going to have time off to look after their children, which is another form of employment discrimination. In total, it's estimated that being forced out of work to care for women results in at least 17% of income loss over a child's lifetime. Over a woman's lifetime. So the structural economic inequality of women, which leads them to being primary carers, simultaneously creates the material basis for the family and the idea that women are just caring maternal figures. This cycle of structural reinforcement and ideological justification is core to capitalism's gender and sexual oppression. And to quickly say a little bit about how this relates to homophobia and transphobia. Whilst there's a level of flexibility to what capitalism will allow to take place, the social identification of sexual minorities against the codependent gender relations is destabilizing. The material basis for sexual oppression that gay and trans people face comes from the necessity of maintaining the material oppression of women in the workforce and the family. Despite the fact that capitalism doesn't really mind anymore that only a small fraction of the working class live in classically married heterosexual families, there will always be an ideological need to reassert the unity of man and woman through the oppression of sexual minorities to maintain gender oppression and maintain gender oppression in the face of resistance. All of this requires a massive rewriting of human history. Despite the monolithic appearances of gender and sexual oppression and the family and the economic exploitation women face at work, gender and sexual oppression is actually a relatively new phenomenon. It's only as old as class society itself, which isn't that old when you put it in the grand scheme. Actually, for the mass majority of human history, gender and sexuality was egalitarian. So where did gender come from? The common conservative view of gender is that there's some universal human nature in which men and women have always had separate roles and always had separate standing and rights since the beginning of time. Very early on in our lives, we're introduced to the image of pre-class societies as one of spear-wielding savages where men went out to hunt and women stayed at home with the children. According to this idea, modern inequalities of gender are simply reflections of the natural realities of patriarchy and the nuclear family. Yet some important archaeological evidence actually paints a very different picture. Mounting studies into pre-class societies, hunter-gatherer societies, show that rather than being riven with gender oppression, they were deeply egalitarian and equal. Take Catahoulik, which is one of the earliest known human societies, established 9,000 years ago in southwest Turkey. An examination of male and female skeletons in Katakuyuk provided a glimpse into its social organization. Archaeologists determined that both sexes ate the same diet, performed the same work, even looked at the smoke residue on their bones to see that they spent the same amount of time indoors. There's no evidence of social hierarchy in life, and they inhabited the same physical spaces in death and in housing. Further studies into the burial practices also showed that individuals that were buried together were not closely related to each other, and that the living and burial arrangements of society demonstrated no notion of some monogamous family structure. A similar finding actually to archaeological digs on pre-class societies around the world. And since then, actually, and remains to be the case today, many of the mythical notions of our prehistoric ancestors have been blown apart. Hunter-gatherer communities had sophisticated practices, which will be discussed here at this conference this weekend. Women were regularly hunters, as depicted here. Child-rearing was communal, and men were often participants. And there was little to no social degradation or any kind of concept of hierarchy assigned to gender or the roles that each gender performed. In fact, there was hardly a notion of gender itself. But this egalitarian organization of society changed when class emerged. Engels argued in The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State that the rise of class society represented the world historic defeat of the female sex. This statement refers to how the division of society into classes necessitated for the first time the creation of fixed notions of gender and sexuality. Whilst in hunter and gatherer groups, things like the sexual activity of their group members was relatively free and was really only limited by what was sustainable for the community and its productive capacity, this changed. As groups settled into surplus-producing societies, which this is a speed run of basically thousands of years of human society, for a series of reasons, offspring were seen as increasingly important through the lens of being potential extra producers. It became more important for the group as a whole for women to abstain from labour and travel in order to increase the rate of reproduction and the likelihood of birth. Over time, this separated women from their once central role in the production of society to separate gendered spheres and tasks. In turn, more strictly defined gender roles emerged for both men and women because of their role in production. With this separation, there became a need to regulate women's sexuality. As social roles became gendered, there became a greater emphasis on men who labored passing their land and other productive roles onto their sons who would go on to be responsible for them. This wasn't an insidious exclusion of women by men. As Sandra Bloodworth writes in a Marxist Left Review article, women as well as men had an interest in changing the lines of inheritance. Women's roles shifted because with the increased numbers of childbirths, it made sense for the lines of inheritance and responsibility for production and management of surpluses to pass to the male line. So rather than patriarchy, women's sexuality is actually historically located in the new needs of production to ensure genealogical connections between particular producers as a social responsibility. However, over time, over thousands of years, classes stratified and social relations concretized out of these new societies into needing, and they needed structures of sexual discipline and gendered oppression in order to maintain a small minority's control over the laboring populace. So rather than the explanation offered by patriarchy theory that women have always been, I'll start to speed wrap up. I realize I've been going for a little while. I wanted to talk a little bit about these guys. Basically the classes that emerged and class society that has since concretized has continued. And today women in the ruling class continue to have different interests than the majority of women. You know, Gina Rinehart here made all of her money by exploiting thousands of workers in her mines and giving them black lung. Kamala Harris broke the glass ceilings on her way to the top by imprisoning thousands of black men and women. Does this make them bad women? No, it actually just makes them, bad people for sure. But it's simply the fact that they're loyal members of their ruling class and they benefit from the oppression that capitalism meters down onto workers, including women. So Women and LGBTI people are not social categories that can be unified as having a singular interest, because women are divided by class. We do not have the same interests as Julia Gillard, who, you know, might have experienced sexism when she was the Prime Minister of Australia, but was actively interested, actually, because of her class position in maintaining gender depression. On the same day that she famously denounced Tony Abbott's sexism, she cut the single parent welfare payments and plunged thousands of single mothers into poverty. The results of this can be seen today, where single mothers on welfare payments can only afford to rent 1.5% of properties on the national market. So they can only afford to rent around 1,200 properties. So that's the result of what is upheld by liberal feminism as a girl boss. So to wrap up, how do we smash this system? Hopefully this talk has led you into thinking or concretized the thoughts that you already had, that we need to rip this fucking system to shreds, which is good because I want to do that too. And that's why I think it's important to say that the difference between Marxism and common explanations of gendered and sexual oppression is that rather than taking the world at appearances, Marxism looks to the root cause. We have to uncover how the system works in its totality in order to totally get rid of it. And when you look at the system behind gender depression, it's clear that rather than blaming it on ordinary people's bad ideas or lack of action, this oppression is contingent upon the ruling class maintaining control over the economic and political structures of society. And so I thought it was only right to throw back to some of the radical women who were part of a revolution in Russia that did just that. The layer under capitalism that has the capacity to take control from the ruling class are the workers. If we refuse to work, the profits run dry. This latent power exists in every workplace across the world, and workers are all united, regardless of whatever ideas they have in their head, by the material reality that that's the case. We all have no interest in running the system for the bosses that exploit us. This power has historically been used to fight for all types of women's liberation and sexual rights, and it's what we need to rebuild. The Radical Builders Labourers Federation downed tools in Sydney to defend a gay university student that had been kicked out of dormitories. And people should go to the session on that incredible history tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. It was union struggle that took away the employer's legal right to outright discriminate against women. It was socialists in Socialist Alternative that said we need to mobilise a mass movement that will create a political crisis from below if we're going to win marriage equality in Australia, and set up an equal love campaign that did just that. There is constant resistance to capitalism. There is constant resistance to gender and sexual oppression, but it doesn't, because it just doesn't make any sense. But it will not always be able to win. And we want to win for good. Every struggle is a debate about how the world can change, and it's the politics of those struggles that can mean victory or defeat. So every session at this conference is about fighting for the politics of human liberation and the working class that can achieve it. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this talk and got something out of it. And I can't wait to hear from everyone in discussion.